Let's just get this. This is an interview with Holloman Winsborough on the 31st of January, 1985. We're talking in his office. I'm Laura Smale of the University Archives Oral History Project. And I would like a little bit about your background to begin with. Are you from an academic family?
No, I'm not from an academic family. My father and mother owned newspapers in East Texas, and we moved from East Texas shortly after my father died in the late 1930s to California. I was an only child, and so I grew up as a only child in a female-headed household, as they say nowadays. Was rather distant from the academy in some sense until I went to the University of Chicago. And
why did you go there?
Well, my mother remarried. We moved to Chicago. I discovered that one could go to the university before you finished high school, and it seemed to, if I was going to suffer the transition from a California high school to an Illinois high school, I might as well go to college, and so I applied and went to the University of Chicago before graduating from high school.
Bob Hauser, who also entered in.
Yeah, Bob and I were several years apart, but in the same kind of program, right? Mm-hmm. Carl Teuber, incidentally, who's now director of the Demography Center, did that at Yale.
Huh.
I didn't know Yale. I mean, I hadn't known that Yale had a program for that, but he proceeded to do
that
at Yale.
That is a coincidence. I just wanted.
Okay.
And what did you major in?
Well, at the University of Chicago in those days, there was a fixed program, and you got a degree in liberal arts. There were 16-year-long courses.
You?
Oh, yeah. Mm. And so the first thing that happened to you when you arrived was you took placement examinations to find out which of these courses you already knew, and then you were assigned to take the rest of them, and that was that. And you marched through and took the rest of these courses and you got a bachelor's degree. And, I entered with a young fellow who was 17 years old who placed out of the whole of the college, which is an interesting event. The university had a problem about that because it couldn't give you a bachelor's degree, but it did admit you directly to graduate school at that point, so he went to study directly for his master's, I guess, in mathematics.
I should think, since more people's backgrounds would have been in literature and mathematics, that it would have steered them into economics, and so that they would end up knowing more about.
You wind up taking all the things that you were bad at.
Yeah.
Because you generally placed out of the things that you were pretty good at. it was kind of a depressing experience.
And what were you bad at?
Well, it turns out I knew very little natural science. I placed out of much of the social sciences, actually, but didn't know very much natural science. And so I took a lot of natural science. They had a three-year sequence in the natural sciences, and I had to take all of it. And it was historically oriented, so that we started by reading Archimedes on Planes and Floating Bodies, mm-hmm. and 3 years later, we read the Special Theory of Relativity and occupied ourselves usefully in the interim, reading other things. It was a weird program, and I enjoyed it thoroughly, and I think I'm a much better social scientist for having done it.
Hmm. Did you intend to go on to graduate school?
Certainly not when I started there, but at some point I decided that I decided I wanted to be an academic before I decided I wanted to be a sociologist. And I decided I wanted to be a social scientist on consumption grounds. I figured that during my lifetime, social science was likely to have more action in general than other disciplines. It seemed to me that there had been an enormous amount of action in physics that even if one became a physical scientist, it would be very difficult to keep up with where the action was outside of your own narrow specialty area because life was so complicated. It seemed to me that the biological sciences were in the midst of a great leap forward, if you will, that for the first half of my lifetime one could probably appreciate the action in biology as a whole, but in the second half of the lifetime it would get so specialized that it would be very difficult to kind of have any scope about the thing or any vision, any sense of what the field as a whole was doing. And so I figured that the social sciences was a good deal for a person whose interests were pleasuring himself and knowing about what was happening, because the action was clearly retarded, but I thought, particularly in the second half of my lifetime, of my working life, that there would probably be a good bit of action. I think I've been right about that. But it would not yet be so specialized that you couldn't more or less keep track of much of it.
You sat and thought this through all on your own?
Yeah, I figured this. I mean, that's what I decided on, how I decided to do this, yeah.
And why did you want to be an academic?
Because a lot of reasons, but one easy one to say is because I just enjoyed knowing about what was going on and what people were thinking. And you could spend your life doing that, so why not? At that point, I wasn't into graduate school. I hadn't been socialized into a production mode, so I was thinking of it mostly from consumption point of view. Seems reasonable.
When were you born, by the way?
1932, the depths of the Depression, so I'm one of those Depression kids, yeah.
All right, well, carry on.
Okay, well, let's see. At the University of Chicago, after I went to graduate school...
Why did you decide to go to the University of Chicago?
Well, it turned out that if you had one of these strange liberal arts degrees that the Hutchins College gave, it was easier to go on to the University of Chicago and get a widely recognized degree because many schools had trouble figuring out what to do with a Hutchins bachelor's degree at that point. And I had accomplished that in 3 years, which meant, and I had entered a year before I would have graduated from high school, so I was like 2 years out of, 2 years
high
into
school,
college,
yeah.
Age-wise, in a sense, and that seems sort of short to many people. So I thought the simple thing to do is go get a master's degree here and then decide if I want to go someplace else to straighten things out. But I found out that the sociology department at Chicago was very good, and I made contact with very good professors, and so I just continued there. For the PhD, and I started working in demography, population statistics, with Philip Hauser, who was a distinguished demographer at the time, and had recently been the director of the Census Bureau for 1950. I was in graduate school then in the latter half of the 50s, having taken 2 years out, a little more than 2 years, over being in the Army in the Korean War. As an enlisted person and teaching electronics in the Signal School at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, which is a strange thing for someone with a liberal arts degree to do, but that's what I did. I went into sociology on the grounds that it was sort of in the middle of the social sciences. I knew I wanted to be a social scientist. And I was torn between whether I wanted to be an economist or a psychologist. And I didn't know which would be more fun. And I thought, well, I will start in sociology, which gives one a good sort of midway there, and there's a lot of room to move out. And so I did that, and would have probably switched if I had not to one or another of those disciplines, had I not come up against demography, which I did primarily by winding up getting a student job doing statistical clerical work for demographers. There was Demography always has been taught and research done in kind of centers in this country. The beginnings of demography in the United States are really at the Office of Population Research at Princeton, starting sometime in the 1920s, I think. At Chicago, there was a center for demography called the Population Research and Training Center that Phil Hauser was director of. And Otis Dudley Duncan, who was my major professor, really, was affiliated with that center. And I worked for the center and had assistantships and fellowships through the center for graduate work. So, like most demographers, I grew up in a center where there were several faculty members pursuing their research activities and a reasonable number of students who were in a department, in that instance mostly in the sociology department, but saw themselves as associated with the center. I wandered around to, after I got my PhD.
On the contrary. Mm-hmm. So did you become interested in demography by default in that you were working in it, or was this also a positive plan?
Not a thing thought out ahead of time. The more I learned about it, the more reasonable it seemed to me as a thing to be interested in. I can be frank. I did not love the rest of sociology at that point and would have left. Sociology in the 1950s was a rather strange business. It was very talky, very theoretical. The theory seemed, what was called theory, didn't seem to me to be very useful for anything, and I had sort of little patience and would probably have made my choice to move off either to psychology or to economics, probably to economics, because psychology was not doing terribly well at Chicago at that point. But then I got hooked up with demography, and that seemed to be very reasonable sort of stuff to me. It's about very fundamental things. It's about getting born and about dying and moving around and how the population replaces itself.
And you had to be good at figures, don't you?
Yeah, it helped.
The sociologist at work has a chapter by somebody who was at Chicago who was studying parties.
David Reisman, he was doing that shortly before I was
there. That's the sort of thing that probably turned you off, is that right?
Well, actually, I thought the Reisman stuff was moderately entertaining. It seemed about something anyway. Now, Reisman wasn't quite sure what Reisman made of it because it never seemed to come to anything. He's a brilliant essayist, still is. But that didn't, at least it was about something, so I never really objected to Reisman, although that's not, most of the people who were in the Demography Center did object to David Reisman, and at that time he was a serious competitor for political power in the Chicago department with Phil Hauser. And Reisman went off to Harvard after Phil became chairman of the department in a kind of a power struggle. It's an odd thing. But I always thought Reisman was interested in something relatively concrete and interesting. But there was a lot of stuff that I thought wasn't very interesting. It seemed to me to be going on very, very formal, very like medieval theology, which I had developed a distaste for in college.
That was one of the things you weren't good at and had to take.
Yes, I think so.
And where did Duncan fit in?
Well, Duncan, Duncan was the one who hired me, and I wound up continuing to work for Duncan partly by default. There were one or two times when I very nearly shifted my major advisor and got out of demography because I was so angry with Dudley Duncan because he's obstreperous guy, and terrifically unpredictable sometimes. But he is also uncanny smart, and it was clearly worthwhile to work with somebody who was so terribly bright and worked so hard. I persisted with him. After getting out of graduate school, I had my first job at Ohio State University, and there was little debography there at that time, and the university and the department particularly had come upon bad days in a sense. It still had a reasonable reputation, which was why I went there. But I got there and discovered it to be a moribund place, and started looking for a place to get out, and particularly a place with more demography. And I got a job offer from Duke University, which is a strange sort of place, but had two distinguished demographers. Joseph Spengler, an economist, a very distinguished economist, a demographer, and another social psychologist demographer, his name is Kurt Bock. Now, Kurt is a Renaissance man and is famous for a lot of different things, but he's also quite a good demographer and worked at the Census Bureau and has done housing studies, and there was a move afoot to put together a training program in demography at Duke University. And there seemed to be a lot of money at Duke, so I went down there and eager to get to know Joe Spengler and Kurt Bock, which is a delightful thing to do. I became kind of the person assigned to actually make the center there. There was not a center, but I was assigned to sort of make it and go get the training grants to do it. The man who was chairman of the sociology department at Duke was a man named John McKinney. He had been hired to make a reasonable department out of a very bad one, and given a fair amount of money to do it. And McKinney was very good at institution building and taught me how to write grant proposals and sort of pointed me in the direction of how one might go ahead and make a center at Duke. And we did. We made a population center with Joe Spengler as the director of it and me as associate director. And we hired Randall Sparley, who is now a distinguished guy at Michigan, as a new assistant professor, and we're putting together a pretty good little center, thank you.
You were awfully young, still, weren't you?
Yeah.
What in your background made them decide at Duke to have you do this?
Well, everybody was very, well, Joe Spengler at that time must have been in his early 60s at any rate. He's been retired a number of years now. He must have been in his early 60s, and he had been kind of a single scholar all his life and was thoroughly prepared to lend his name and wisdom to any kind of a institution building thing, but he sure wasn't going to do it. He had books to write and stuff like that. And So I got assigned to this just because I was the personnel that was there to do it. And I sort of took to it and did it rather well.
You didn't mind spending your time on grant requests?
No, not particularly. And one little piece of my history, that's two little pieces of my history that are curious and interesting, maybe. One is that my mother, when she remarried a man who was really a propagandist or advertising man. And before I went to the University of Chicago, I lived in a household with him. And he rather self-consciously taught me to write. And he taught me to write in the fashion of an advertising person, of a salesman, in a sense. That is, words for a purpose, for a motivational purpose. And he was good at it. He made very good money and was the president of a consulting firm before he retired and did very well. And during the Second World War was in the propaganda business in the military.
What did you mean on Saturday mornings?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he began by having me edit his stuff. I was 16 years old. Wow, yeah. Isn't that neat? And he sort of told me what to look for. And he fussed at me about, sentences get too long. Wind up using too fancy words and stuff like that. So you read this and tell me what I've done wrong according to this set of principles. And so I would edit his stuff. And he was receptive to that in some sense. And then he would give me little assignments, write a paragraph about this. All really quite related to his work. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea why he did that, but I learned an enormous amount. Before I went to graduate school, but after I was in the Army, I also worked at the University of Chicago in the development office, the money-raising office, which at a place like the University of Chicago is a desperately serious business. And my job was primarily to there was a big campaign going on to raise money, and my job was to be sure that people didn't say anything wrong, so that again I had to go read speeches that people were going to give, and as somebody had put in this, that, or the other factual reference to what happened, I had to go check it out and be sure that it was right and so on, and then rewrite that part of the speech. So I had a fair amount of experience in writing.
You had this as a graduate student?
Before I went to graduate school.
Hard to imagine many people capable of doing that.
I don't know, never did seem too amazing to me at the time. But then, so I could then and can now write things that convince people to cough up money. Mm-hmm. And that's been my major gift.
Valuable talent.
So I did that at Duke and got the got a training grant and so on, and established a center. And we had a pretty good little center, and we trained some quite good students, and was there a total of 5 years, Ren Farley and I. Ren came maybe 2 years after I was there, and so we overlapped for 3 years and ran it jointly for 3 years, really, with both Kurt and Joe very much in evidence, but Ren and I really did it.
Were you working with computers?
Yes, Duke had... Duke was moving into the computer era in a great three-university consortium to produce a large computer for that period of time through the Triangle Universities Institute. And there was a thing called the Triangle Universities Computing Center, which was a big deal. The three universities would get together, the three universities being University of North Carolina, Duke, and North Carolina State University in Raleigh, who are sort of spaced out in as points of a triangle, and in the middle there was a great research park that the then governor of North Carolina had declared to be a development project for the state as a whole, and there was going to be this research and development park established there. It is, it's worked, it's a terrific thing. But as a feature of that, they were going to put new computing facilities that the three universities would share there in that park. And so we had access to that. Each university had a fairly fancy computer as a terminal, in a sense, to that stuff. All small potatoes now by size and so on, but it was very big and very expensive and very fancy at the time. The Bureau of the Census was in process of releasing the first of its public use samples for this 1960 census. And Dudley Duncan, my major advisor, said, why don't you get a hold of this and see what you can make of it? So I did like I was told, and we got that thing and set it up to run on the computing center that was there. It was very hard to do, and some weird things happened, and if we hadn't been at a place that was very rich and the beginning of something, I doubt we could have ever gotten the amount of time or computing resources, which were quite expensive, but they would let me have the whole thing on Sunday mornings, and so we would go out to the top and operate the thing on Sundays and finally get everything to work right so we could process this very large file for that time period of data.
So you actually were doing this, so you had to know.
We learned a reasonable amount about it.
So how did you learn how to work on the computer?
Well, that's an odd story. I suppose everybody kind of picked up stuff in those days as best you could. When I was in the Army, teaching in the Signal School, one of the things to learn about was about the kinds of computers that were there at the time. So I learned something about the kinds of computers that fire control devices and so on, which are by and large analog computers. Some of us would fool around trying to make relays into counting circuits just for fun. We didn't really have enough. We were really in the telephone business mostly, and the teletype operations and very long distance multi-channel telephone business. So we had access to a lot of relay equipment, and so we would just amused ourselves by making these cascade counters and so on out of the relays that were laying around. When I went back to the University of Chicago, as I got on towards the dissertation, why the university acquired an early computer, UNIVAC 1, I think, for goodness sake, and I wound up running some regressions on that machine. But that was interesting because you didn't do it yourself. It was very sanitized, and you sort of submitted things through a long channel. It was as though it was somebody was afraid that if social sciences touched it, it would get sick, which struck me as very odd since I had been taking them apart in the Army or things like that. At Ohio State had quite nice computing facilities for that period of time and a device for teaching faculty members, and so I went and took a course offered by an IBM fellow and had access to a 709, and which was a relatively large machine of the generation before the 360s, and also a 1620, I think it was, which was a weird machine, a sort of card-based, and that looked up. So I learned to do a little bit of programming, and the IBM fellows' lectures, which I went to, three times a week for a semester, perhaps, were very, very good, and he had us programming, and started us off programming in machine language, and then moved to assembler, and then we moved to Fortran. I learned a certain amount about how a machine would work. Went to Duke. When I first got there, had a terribly small machine, which was very awkward, and I had very little to do with it except frustration trying to make it go. And then as we got this new machine, it was a new 360, you see, which was a new generation machine, fairly different than others. And so to some degree, there was a kind of a starting over. And by getting manuals and so on, I could keep up with those people and do all right. Mm-hmm. And besides, I was a social scientist who had problems that it was clear were appropriate for the computer. And people who ran computers in those days were pretty interested in having diffusing the demand beyond physicists and engineers. It was clear to them that the university was spending a lot of resources on this, and it ought to be useful to other people, but there is a problem of how do we generate the demand so this doesn't just look like a goodie for the hard types. Mm-hmm.
All right.
So in 1967, I was hired by the University of Wisconsin to come and be director of the Center for Demography here.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You aren't going to let it go that simply, are you? And who hired you?
Okay. Who hired me? Well, Russell Middleton was the chairman of the department at that time. Norman Ryder was the director of the center and had been center director for about 5 years at that point, I think. Mm-hmm. I understand that the center was established in 1962 and that Ryder was the first center director. And the center had gotten a training grant. I really do need to tell you more. I'm trying to sort out where, you know, what do I know and what's hearsay here.
Well, it would be useful to know what had happened to the center in the 5 years before you came, and you must know something about it more than...
By hearsay. Mm-hmm. And by what I found when I got here.
Yeah. All right, well, I'll let you tell it your own way, but whatever you know.
Well, let me just try to tell the center history as I I've heard it, and what little I know about it. I understand that the center got started as a part of the SSRI, the Social Systems Research Institute, that Guy Orcutt put together. Guy rounded up people, I understand, in the social sciences, tried to get them to establish centers and work together. And I gather it was a grand idea and eventually didn't work for some reason, which I don't understand. Norman Ryder was one of the people that he rounded up, apparently, and Orcutt reasonably thought there ought to be demography in this social systems research center, and Norman was supposed to be the demographer. Norman is an extremely capable demographer and a brilliant man, and it shows Orcutt's good taste to have latched onto him. So Norman says that, Orcutt said that they were going to be a center, and he had an office. We were just moving into the social sciences building, I think, someplace in there. Mm-hmm. But there was an office that had some desk calculators in it and had census volumes in it. And so Norm had a sign made, called it the Center for Demography, and put it on the door, and that was how it got started. And it existed as a name on a door for a couple of years. During that period of time, the Department of Sociology hired two other young demographers who were very capable. One was Carl Teuber, who is the current center director. Carl had been at the University of Chicago in the Population Center along with me, although he was getting his PhD at Harvard under Sam Stauffer. He was doing it on residential segregation, and Sam said, go to Chicago and work with Dudley Duncan because he knows more about this, and when you've written the dissertation, might bring it back and we'll degree you at Harvard, which is what they did. So Carl was I had known Carl at Chicago, and Carl did a brief stint at Berkeley under Kingsley Davis. Carl and Kingsley Davis fell out vigorously, and Carl left in the middle of the year, or something like that, went back to Chicago, and then came up here. The other person that was hired here was another fellow student at the University of Chicago named Stanley Lieberson. Stanley Lieberson is a student of ethnicity. His most recent book is called A Piece of the Pie, for which he's gotten all manner of prizes, and Stanley now is a professor in the department at Berkeley. Stanley left the same time that I came in 1967. So sometime in the very early 60s, between 62 and 64, why don't we back up to Lieberson left? Because the straightforward and sensible story, without getting involved in too many ifs, ands, and buts about why Lieberson left, was that his wife couldn't stand it here.
Oh.
Just straightforwardly that. And by that time, Stanley had three kids, and his wife had had a very hard time here. She'd had one kid after another. It was very cold. Stanley was working terrifically hard to make tenure. He is a driven person anyway. He felt himself to be in competition with Leo Schnorr. Do you know who Leo is?
Yes, I do.
Okay, well, Leo was a wreck of his former self. In his earlier years, Leo wrote with both hands and published six articles in a book every year. And these poor young demographers thought that that was what you had to do, and Leo let them, and Norm let them. And so poor old Stanley was working his head off. His wife was having baby after baby and having no help from hubby, and it was damn cold here. And she eventually decided, God damn it, I live here. We'll do this. And so Stan had been looking around to go someplace else. And we cooked up a deal that came apart, but there was this wild deal that four of us would go out to Seattle, and they would hire all of us at one time, and we would make a center there. There had been an old center, and the fellow that had run it was getting old. I mean, it was retiring, and it had a name, and some resistance, and so the people who ran that place decided they would hire young crew of demographers in.
This is you still at Duke?
When I was still at Duke, and Stanley was known to be on the market because Pat was so miserable. And there was a fellow named Bill Hodge at Chicago who was another student at Chicago, but one who had been hired on at Chicago. And his wife, Patty, his wife at that time, Patty Hodge. So those guys were going to hire us all. I was going to go be director, and these people were going to come, and I was going to bureaucratize the place, and these guys were going to do their research thing. And by God, they coughed up the money and made offers to all of us. And it all came apart one way and another. Partly it came apart because Bill and Patty Hodge were unbeknownst to any of us in the process of falling out. And within 6 months later, they were divorced. And that led to weird behavior on their part. And the University of Michigan then proceeded to where Duncan moved to Michigan at that time, and Michigan offered Stanley a job to counter that, and Stan didn't know what he wanted to do. And whenever Patty and Bill fell out, and Stanley and I consulted about whether the two of us just ought to go. And Stan wasn't at all sure because there was the Michigan offer. He didn't know quite what he wanted to do. And so at that point, I decided come apart, and I told him no. And then Stan had his argument with himself about was he going to go to Michigan or was he going to go to Seattle, and he went to Seattle because it was a nice place. It was warmer, and his wife would be happier there. It's an interpersonal story, very curious, well, but not necessarily useful for the archive.
They're almost indispensable at times to understand why things happen. But,
but the truth of the matter is that Pat Lieberson developed a terrific distaste for this town.
And didn't stay long enough to overcome it.
Didn't stay long enough to overcome it. She stayed long enough for her husband to get tenure here. And about that. 3 years, 4 years. And the place annoyed her. She had the intolerance for some of Madison's flakier things. The endless go-rounds about the, what are we going to do about a convention center? Okay. I mean, she just thought that was just so stupid. And then just settled down on the side. And her position was really a lot like Soglin's eventually was. You know, if you can't do this thing with a Frank Lloyd Wright Center, we'll do something, for God's sake. That was all before the troubles ensued. If she'd been here during the troubles, I'm sure she really would have gone home. So where are we? Maybe we should...
Well, you are coming here in 1967.
Okay. Are we running or not?
Yes, we are.
Oh, I thought you
knew that.
No, I didn't know that.
Well,
I was just rambling. Okay. Okay, came here in 1967. And have I said... I can't remember what we've put in and left out.
Right.
Have we done the stuff about Orcutt and so on? Yes.
Yes, and you had said that Norm Ryder, that they had hired two young demographers, and you mentioned
Lieberson
their names.
Thank you. And Teuber and Lieberson had left. They had an additional very distinguished demographer, Leo Schnorr, who wrote with both hands and mostly did human ecology. And that's why the center is named the Center for Demography and Human Ecology. In 1964, a grant was submitted for a training grant in demography. Now, I know that to be a fact, and because I read the grant at Duke, because it was to the same program that I submitted at my grant proposal to Duke. The grant proposal had a lot of people on it, including the then chairman, Ed Borgata. I suspect Ed was the motive force to spur Norm Ryder to apply for this training grant. It had Ed's hand all over it, rather different than something Norman might have done. So Ed, I think, dreamed up what he thought a center ought to be like and went off and got a training grant to train students in demography. I think it didn't fly the first time that it went through, and so they reapplied. And the second application, they got the money. In those days, your training grant went on for 5 years, and you reapplied in the fourth year or something like that. I think I was hired because the training grant was coming up for renewal. Ed Borgata was no longer chairman. The center had not very dramatically taken hold, although it had some 9 students taking the training grant money. It hadn't become a very coherent affair. And it was about time to reapply for the money. And I suspect that the older hands in the department looked things over and decided that if Norm, unless somebody did something, they weren't going to get refunded. So they hired me to come do something. Mm-hmm. And I did. When I arrived, there were, as I say, 9 students. There was about $60,000 of training money in the center. It employed a secretary. And that was it. And it was about its training grant was about to die and needed to be reapplied for. At the same time that I was hired, we hired Jim Sweet from the University of Michigan. Jim is still here, was the center director after me. So it became, the center wasn't a center. It was a collection of faculty. There was a room that had a few books in it, as I've said, and a bunch of students, and not a very tidy program. In order to renew the training grant, it seemed clear to me the first thing we needed to do was to figure out what the training program was in demography and what the courses were. So we sat down and listed a bunch of courses, and I came to discover that there were core courses in the training thing, technical courses in demography, which hadn't been offered for a very long time. I found that out by going to a guy's student's oral preliminary examination, asking him questions about technical demography, and found he knew nothing. Norm Ryder's a terrific technical demographer. And this student, who was clearly quite bright, didn't know anything about this. And everybody was saying, well, he's kind of lazy. And I started looking back in the records, and nobody had offered formal demography in the period of time the student had been here. So we set up a regime to offer the courses on an orderly basis and so on. And we refunded the training grant and got some more students in the house, organized to hire some additional assistant professors in demography in the following year or two, and went out and got some research money, research grant money, and began to produce a more or less coordinated research and training activity. Now, all of this, you have to realize, was in the midst of the Vietnam War, and the world was coming apart around us, and we would hire students who would, on the training grant, who would turn into young radicals and never show up, and then we would have to take their training grant money away and be bad folk, and it was really quite awful. I was at that time fairly closely associated with the Census Bureau through a Population Association of America Committee on Population Statistics.
And so I knew what the Bureau was planning to do for release of data for 1970. This now is in 1968 or 69. I'd been on that committees about that for several years. A census starts being planned 5-6 years mm-hmm. before it happens, of course. And so I knew a good bit about what was going on in the thing, in the census. And I knew that the plans for 1970 were to release a very large volume of data that was to be machine readable. In 1960, what had been released was a 1 in 1,000 sample of the population, which came on a lot of reels of tape at the density of those tape density of those days, but wasn't just an enormous amount of money or enormous amount of data. It didn't take an enormous amount of money to deal with it, but it was fairly hard to deal with. I knew that in 1970. The Census Bureau was going to produce a great volume of data on tape. And it seemed clear to me that a group of demographers, a training center in demography, that seemed to fairly well specialize in doing demography of the United States was going to be in bad shape if it couldn't cope with this outpouring of data. Instead of a 1 in 1,000 sample, there was going to be 1 in 100 samples. And there were going to be 3 of these 1 in 100 samples with different geographic coding. And then there was going to be a great wonder of data that was tabular, but on machine-readable form, for very small areas, like city blocks. Well, that, just a great deal of stuff. So I started snooping around about how we would cope with this material in the university. The university at that time was going to buy a Burroughs 8500 computer that Burroughs had in the design stage. The University of Wisconsin and U.S. Steel were two of the major money on the line buyers for this Burroughs machine, which was supposed to be very advanced technology, and was a seriously interesting piece of equipment. Now, if they'd been able to make it, it would have been great, but they never were able to make it. Okay, but the situation we were in on campus was that we had old CDC equipment, which was clearly going to go away, which was quite awkward to deal with. Nice equipment if you wanted to do mathematical calculations. It was difficult equipment if you wanted to process a lot of data. In preparation for the Burroughs 5500 or the Burroughs 8500, there was a Burroughs 5500 on campus, originally 1 and then 2. When I first came here, I felt as though I had fallen back into the dark ages of computing because the CDC equipment was appreciably less satisfactory than the IBM equipment at Duke and at the Triangle Center. Fairly shortly, we were permitted to use the Burroughs equipment, and so we, just about the time we got organized to run 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 files comfortably on the CDC stuff, by then we were allowed to use the Burroughs equipment, so we had to shift to the Burroughs 5500, which was a very nice machine, except it wouldn't run very reliably. It kept breaking down. Physically breaking down. We set up procedures for doing that, and I started getting a bunch of programming done. A fellow who had been a programmer for me at Duke got an NSF to come here in mathematics and computer science and started helping me out and eventually working for me to get stuff going here. So we switched over and started using the Burroughs 5500. Then it became clear that the 8500 was never going to be made, and so in a very brief period of time, the 5500 disappeared and we got a UNIVAC. And by this time I had been here 2 years, and I'd been through 3 wildly different computing systems. Now I thought the UNIVAC was going to be just marvelous, because the Census Bureau runs UNIVACs. I mean, it's a data processing machine. And I thought it was going to be great. And so we started doing stuff, and I could get a lot of work done quite inexpensively. And then they started changing the way they build for that machine. And so I would write stuff that would process large files according to the billing algorithm then to do efficiently. And then they changed the billing algorithm. And I knew I have to go back and take everything apart to cope with the billing algorithm. A change in the way you bill was as bad as a change in a machine for me, because I wanted to do the same data processing tasks literally millions of times, and so small money savings on each act were important. And at that point, I just threw up my hands, because if we were going to change machines and then change billing algorithms, there was no way that we were going to get the stability necessary to process this 1980 data. And if we couldn't process the 1980 data, we were going to be in deep trouble as a center focusing on U.S. stuff. Well, it turned out that an agency in NIH had a new granting authority to provide centers grants for demography centers. It was a new concept of supporting centers, and it was done in through the Institute of Child Health and Human Development and through a thing which was called the Population Center there. It was partly to do research. The Population Center was supporting reproductive biology and contraception research primarily, and still primarily, but also to maintain its virtue and so on, was supporting basic research in demography. And so they had this Centers grant, which was designed to support demography centers. Very sensible. That's the way demography is done. And also primate centers, primate research centers, and large groups of reproductive biologists who also are a fairly groupy bunch. Well, so when I heard about this, why I started inquiring right away is...
Don't touch the cord.
Okay. Right away, I started figuring out whether this was a way to get a computer. And it looked like it was, so we wrote a proposal to those people. In which proposal it was, give us a computer. That was kind of a weird thing to do in the set, like 1969, 1970.
Why?
Well, the only social scientist that I knew who had a computer of their own was Jim Coleman. His name may or may not mean anything, but Jim Coleman was a big-time sociologist. Wrote the Coleman Report on school segregation way back when, did several versions of that. And he had been at Chicago and was an assistant professor when I was a graduate student there, and I'd had a lot of courses with Jim and almost switched from Dudley to become Jim's student at one point. And he had an IBM 1401 or something like that at Johns Hopkins, a small IBM machine. But as far as I knew, he was the only guy who had a computer.
You mean because one computer can do too much for a small group?
Fantasy at that time was that the doctrine was that computers were like a public utility, that the university ought to have one great big enormous one, and that everybody would use that great big enormous one. Mm-hmm. And so there was this public utility model of what the computer was supposed to be. And most universities at that time period would not let a individual faculty member or research group buy their own computer. Hmm. They just would prohibit it. Only because this is such a populist university was it possible for me to do that. If I'd been at University of Michigan, I could never have gotten it done. The university wouldn't have permitted it.
Who gave you permission? What was the process?
Well, the nature of the University of Wisconsin is that to some degree, if a faculty member wants to do something and has somebody who might very well give them the money to do that particular thing, it isn't so much that he has to ask permission, but that somebody in some kind of a review process has to say he can't. And there was a lot of review processes, particularly for this proposal, which might very well have said that we couldn't do this, but it would have been not... It wasn't an issue of giving permission. It was an issue of refusing to allow it to go forward, in some sense. And there's a serious difference in those things, because the second becomes an act of that has something to do with academic freedom and the most amazing things on this campus, not on others. The way it was structured in this campus, that was a serious thing.
This is 1970.
Well, 1970, 70, 69, 70, whenever we were starting doing this.
So, and you were dealing with the LNS dean and the graduate school and the
and
vice chancellor.
And the university computing committee.
Yes. Which was dealing with the crisis at UWCC
which was
at that time.
Dealing with the crisis, and of course I had a lot of moral authority at this point, because we had been through all this terrible business, and I had just sat through three computer changes, and I had a good story to tell about why I wasn't prepared to wait to see whether the UNIVAC worked out.
Yeah.
You can see that there was a certain amount of embarrassment there, and it would have been a little hard to put a stop to it.
Do you remember anybody in particular that was sympathetic to, or Don Percy was on the committee, Clodius was? Any names that you remember?
Well, I can remember having to go defend myself before the University Computing Center to a bunch of people that I have gotten to know subsequently. They
Rayfield
gave us a very hard...
Is that right? Muller had resigned by then.
Yeah, Muller had resigned. Rayfield was probably the director of MAC at that point in time. But he was about to go, and I think that Larry Travis was about to take over in his first incarnation as MAC director. The truth of the matter is that Larry Travis and Dean Bach were always extremely helpful in this matter. That is, when push came to shove, they stood up and said the right things. Terrifically impressive show. Terrifically impressive, from my point of view. So that when we got site visited, why, those guys didn't... I had a considerable argument with the computing center, who was not delighted to see a good deal of potential business go down the drain. I said, I'm going to do it this way. And they did not give me a bad time. They did not stab me in the back. It was terrific. Just terrific.
Here, I might as well turn. This is take two of the interview with Hal Winsborough.
It took two rounds to get that grant funded. We were site visited on the first round, and as I remember, the main thing was that everybody thought that it was just terrifically risky to let somebody buy a computer. So there were a series of kind of pro forma objections and stuff like that.
Risky? Why?
Well, I mean, it seems strange today, doesn't it? I mean, everybody, you can go down to TV Lenny's and buy your own computer. And that computer would be bigger and faster than the machine we were fixing to deal with. It really is true. But the demographers who came thought that we would spend all our time operating the computer and that it would just be a constant drain for us. And there was question about whether or not we were capable of doing it. Can you run your own computer? There was a reasonable amount of resistance from older folk on the committee that if we did that, they might have to go out and do likewise, to be frank about it. And
you
so
mean on
we,
the site visit committee?
So on the site visit committee. And so essentially we got told to revise and resubmit, which we did. And that meant that wasted a year.
Yeah.
But in that year, everybody had thought about it for a while. And the other thing was that we were the first grant in on this new granting authority, don't you see? And I think that some of the, if I had realized that we were going to be the first in the line, I might very well have held off, because this was a very risky thing to do for the agency, to give its first grant in this way. It would be easier for the agency's first grant to be smaller and more routine.
Mm.
And so we wound up being the second or third grant, no, third or fourth grant, I think, that they gave. and by that time it was all right for them to do something unusual. So eventually we got our machine.
Was it important to them, the people that you had here?
Oh, yes. But we were not hugely distinguished at that time. Mm. We were a bunch of young folk. Norman was very distinguished. Leo Schnorr was well regarded, but at that point, Leo was beginning a series of manic depressive illnesses, had been actually for some time, that has eventually disabled him completely. So that Leo was Leo's professional career was very much on a decline, and many people knew that, and everyone was very sad about it. So we were a bunch of upstarts, young upstarts. And, but we got our money, and we rented our computer, our IBM computer. I should tell you a story about how we decided what to get.
Yes.
I was quite unsure about what to do. I chatted, and particularly uncertain about what to do, given the university's flopping around about what kind of computer it wanted and changing gears so many times. Before Merv Muller left, I had talked to Merv about this and about how should I find out what to do, and Merv said, go see the man who runs the academic or the data processing center, computing center. Now, I can't remember this man's name. This was a...
Was it Ted Wheezy or Catter?
Catter. He was before Wheezy, right? Dennis Catter, is that right?
Yes.
And he sort of started off, and it was quite a small enterprise to begin with, right?
Well, that's a mixed story, too, because there's...
A lot of stories.
There's the Madison campus and the center system, and they were at odds with each other for administrative data processing.
Right. So I think it was Dennis Catter that Merv Muller told me to go. We had this conversation, and Merv, who had been an old IBMer and disliked IBM, I mean, he'd come from IBM Corporation. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Well, that was one of the... Yeah, there was a strong anti-IBM bias.
I see. That
crew.
Explains a lot.
Yeah, there was the academy was full of people who had left IBM in the process of the 360 development, who had been important intellectual leaders in the 360 thing, and then it sort of gotten pushed out and disliked the company. North Carolina had a similar man who came in, and Merv was that way. But at any rate, Merv said, you really do want an IBM machine for what you want to do. What you want to do is very like what a bank wants to do. IBM makes good machines like that. I don't know anything about them, but go see Dennis Catter, I think. And so I went to see Dennis Catter. And Dennis Catter listened to my story and my level of knowledge and naivete, and he said, if I were you, I would go see the local IBM salesman, whose name is Joe Movizzo, and I would tell Joe my story, and I would pretty well buy what Joe tells you to buy, because he's an honest man, and he won't overload you, and it'll work. And that's what I did. And Joe Movizzo was a very ambitious, up-and-coming young IBM salesman who was terrific. He understood what we needed to do. He understood the level of hand-holding that we were going to require. But after all, that's IBM's business. It was at that time setting up for lots of businesses to run computers where the business had never done anything like that before. So they were right into it. And that seemed to me the thing to do. We would go let Mama IBM hold our hand and get us started whenever we were beginning, and then we would see what we would do after that. I mean, I had that strategy from the beginning. I think I might have gone IBM even if Merv Muller hadn't told me to. And Joe Movizzo did not cheat us. He set us on, sell us more equipment.
But
than
you
we
rented
needed.
It.
We rented the equipment, yeah. Why did we rent the equipment? Well, I wasn't sure how long we were going to stay with the IBM equipment. I was not at all sure that we weren't going to need to upgrade fairly seriously. I was right. The equipment that we initially had was not sufficient. We wound up never paying any more rental to IBM than we paid initially, but the quality of the equipment went up massively during our period of renting that equipment. It was a good time to be in with IBM. So they got us started. And by the time they started to release, so we got our money, IBM got us started, and we opened our computer center in 71 or 72. It says in the book there sometime. Mm-hmm. And we had a computer center before they released public use sample files from the 70 census, which was what I wanted to do, and we started right away trying to process those files. We've been at that ever since. It was very exciting to do that. Mm-hmm. But then shortly thereafter, after the computer was here and running and things were going to be all right, I had been director for 5 years, somehow, come 72. I decided, earlier on, I had decided that the center here should deviate from all other centers and should have a rotating directorship, that it should behave like a department that has a chairmanship that rotates. That's uncharacteristic of most demography centers, and it certainly is uncharacteristic of centers in the biological sciences, where the major professor is the boss and runs things forever. But I thought in the social sciences and in demography and in the field that is in the midst of very rapid change that it was important to make like a department and have turnover in the director. And so we invented a regime to turn the directorship over essentially every 5 years. It was a little hard on our major grantors, that is the people who gave us the training grant and the center grant, that have granted this money to one director, expecting that to be the way it was forever, and then to find that we were changing directors. But and they have always grumbled as we've changed directors, but we do it anyway, and we're right. And it means that you have a fresh eye to what's important coming in. And has all the virtues of changing chairman regularly. 5 years is a better stint for running a research center than is 3 years somehow. In 5 years you can really do something, although by the end of the 5 years everybody gets tired, blasé. Mm-hmm. There's been enough crises that you just don't respond with enough adrenaline to a new crisis. Sort of, oh, the money's all going to go away next week. Well, I'll worry about that tomorrow.
Is there enough incentive to get people to want to be director?
Well, I don't know. Not really. People do it. People do it because that's how we do our business. Almost everybody in the center was raised in another center. So many centers now turn over directorship since we started doing it. So making one's contribution to the center is just part of what you do. You pay your dues. People get an enormous amount of goodies by being in this center. Mm. I mean, we have our own library. If you run out of travel money and want to go to a meeting, why, there's a kitty that will send you to the meeting. Bob Hauser got an offer of a named professorship at Yale at one point. Offers a name professorships from every university in America, I guess, but at one point some years ago he got an offer of a name professorship at Yale, and he was trying to figure out what would he need to replace what he had here, and he calculated up the market value of the computing that he had done on our center. That is what he would have to pay at our university's computing rates, which are less than Yale's. Yale is very high priced. To replace that, and it came to $75,000.
Yes.
That's what it would pay for that, you see. And so he asked them whether they were interested in giving him $75,000 to compute, and they decided they weren't really, and he was pleased. So you can see that centers are weird, this center particularly, but centers in general are kind of weird, demography centers. They are producers' co-ops, is what they are. We share our resources. We do it in some ways that are at the margins of accounting legality. We are always inside the margin, but...
You mean in terms of grants?
Yes, and of federal monies in general. We're always inside those margins, and we now have a absolutely first-rate great accountant to make sure we're inside those margins. But basically, it's a co-op, and we buy things that we need in common, and there are communal goods that we acquire, and it works pretty much on a from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. And we expect that assistant professors will be net takers in their early years, and we just that's just how it's supposed to be, and they shouldn't worry about it. So they it's a great place to be an assistant professor. It's like having a grant for $100,000 a year, I guess, to be an assistant professor here because the laboratory facilities are so good. And then, as one gets older, one makes more contributions. That's just how it goes. And it works.
It really does, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really works.
I mean, there must be frictions around the edges.
Well, there's grumbling around the edges. My goodness, there's a lot of grumbling around the edges. You know, why do I have to go to this meeting? I have to go to this meeting because it, there's a reasonable number of meetings that are required to run an enterprise that's as big as this. So it's a pretty big place now. When I came, it had about $60,000 a year in money. When I stopped being director and Jim started being director, we were spending about $1 million a year in research money and center grant money and training money. And we had an enterprise that was in the way towards being recognized as a major research facility. We had moved from 5 or 6 faculty members to probably having 15. What else do you need to know?
How is it in relation to the department as a whole? What is its position?
Well, it is the Demography Center here has a relationship with the department as a whole. It's very uncharacteristic of other demography centers. We have always been in the same building with the department, which is an important thing. Most other demography centers are separate buildings. The faculty go to the center when they're being center members, and they go to the department when they're being teaching members. And people who are not center members but in the department come to the centers by invitation. And so really seriously, that way. The Office of Population Research at Princeton is in the old Cannon Club, which was, I think, Fitzgerald's eating club at Princeton. It has panels, and is a, you know, is an eating club a building? Paneled walls, and it's an absolutely gorgeous building that houses the center. Here we, our activities were originally in the on the third floor, which is very nearly the basement floor, the ground floor of this building, in quarters that were not very attractive for a very long time. And we have been in the same building with faculty members in the in our center and in other centers interspersed. That's been very good. It's kept us from getting too narrowly demographic. It's probably been good for the department, too. Our relations with the department have been one of a kind of a fairly permeable membrane. We've had a reasonable number of people, assistant professors, hired here not to be demographers, but something else, who have, in the course of their being here, become demographers. So some of them have gone other places. Karen Mason is a relatively well-known sociologist now at the University of Michigan. She came here having been trained as a survey researcher, more or less became a demographer here, and then moved off and is now in the Demography Center at Michigan. So there's a fair amount of that going on. Mm-hmm. We have taken people, we've encouraged a reasonable amount of demographic-like work by people who are really not demographers, who's in their heart of hearts not demographers, but something else, but who do work that gets funded by people who fund demography things and published in demography journals. So we've run a much more open boundary between the department and the center. And was originally, than most other places do. And that very self-consciously. We, Carl and I, Carl Teuber and I, both felt very strongly that was a good way to do it. Otherwise, you can become too isolated a group. And demography does look very different than the rest of sociology and behaves differently and so on. And so you can become the out-grouper in the department and there can be fights, and so we've just avoided that. We have done the best we can to share our resources with the department, sort of at the margin. We come right down to the margin of what's legal and try not to step across it. Eventually, so we've had this computer, we have let people use it in the department as best we could, and eventually I had a computer left over from a large grant of my own, and we argued around about should we keep that computer in the department and in the center, and eventually said no, we'll give it to the department. So the department now has its own computer, which is identical to the one that we have.
This is the IBM from Kansas.
No. Neither of these are IBM machines. We shifted off of the IBM and bought a VAX 11780.
Well, I know you have a VAX, but was the thing, isn't this from Kansas that
you're
saying?
Yes, right, and that was a VAX tip.
Oh, I see.
We decided that when Larry was center director, Jim Sweet was center director after I was, and Jim kept trying to get the rules changed at NICHD to permit us to buy rather than rent this machine. It was his notion that we should be capitalizing this money that NICHD was giving us. Mm-hmm. That we shouldn't be putting it out in rent. We should be capitalizing it. And this, of course, was just at the time that budgets were getting squeezed, and we didn't know whether they were going to continue to have money. Yeah. Jim was never able to get the agency to shift gears on that, or the university to get its act together. Finally, Larry Bumpus, when he put in his round of center grant renewal proposals. We put it in, the agency was prepared to let us think about buying a machine. We put in to buy the IBM machine because we thought that the people, rather conservative social scientists who would come, wouldn't let us do anything else but to buy IBM. We were very lucky. We got several terrifically good site visit members who knew a good bit about computing. And these people came to us and said, there were also some very conservative people on that site visiting, and they came to us and said, you're bananas buying this IBM machine. You're going to pay a lot more. And we said, we know we're bananas, but you guys are never going to give us the money to buy something else. And they said, let us handle that. Do you want to do it? And I said, sure, what we want is a VAX 11780. That would be what we would like to have. Now, why did I know I wanted that? Because Larry Landweber in the computer science department and I had been on a committee to review the statistics department together and had spent some time talking. And Larry had explained to me what we ought to do. And so we worked this deal in the midst of this site visit that those guys would go a lot. They would allow us to rearrange what it was we were going to do on the fly, and give us permission to take bids on something other than an IBM machine. She was just terrific. So we got the VAX and shifted from being a batch processing operation to being this interactive operation, and a lot of other good things. And then on the 4050 project, which is another story, I also had to buy another machine to use on that project, and so we bought identical machines, essentially not absolutely identical, but basically the same. So when the 4050 project was over, we brought that here to the department. And now the department has to suffer with a computer, too.
Well, they must have been delighted.
Yeah, well, it can be a kind of a cuckoo's egg, you know.
Yes.
But they seem not, they don't seem too grumpy about it. Let me see, what do we want to back up and pick up?
What were you about to say?
I can't remember.
You said you'd tell me a couple of things about. I mentioned the Survey Research Lab and the Poverty Institute.
Okay. There are several, our relations with several other agencies are probably, in the university, are probably sort of interesting. When the Poverty Institute was sort of brand new when I arrived, a new thing on the block, had a lot of money, and we were struggling and just beginning. Harold Watts, who was director of the Institute then, was terrifically facilitative in helping us get going, sort of providing funds for research activities by the junior faculty member who were coming into the center at one time or another. Jim Sweet did a lot of research with Poverty Institute funds, and so Harold was enormously collegial about that. And we have tried to, as times go on, pay our debts to the Poverty Center as they came on hard times at one time or another by putting grants through the Poverty Institute and things like that. People in our center have felt a good bit of a family feeling with the Poverty Institute. It's one of the things that's odd around here. People behave like that, behave like it was family, and pay their debts and do things like that. The SSRI is an interesting story, and maybe it's useful to say a few things for the record about that. When I first came here, SSRI was still supposed to be the vehicle for interdisciplinary research in the social sciences. I was right away put on their board of directors and was amazed at what a weird enterprise it had become by that time. It seemed entirely occupied by economists who are fighting over the spoils. There was very little money left or resources left, but there seemed to be this kind of endless squabble about these leftover crumbs from this enterprise. There were a few other non-economic social scientists on the committee about this, and they seemed similarly puzzled, but I was brand new and from someplace else, and so I think I was particularly amazed. It seemed to me that there were some people who were kind of in mourning for an idea that was clearly not going to work. Dick Day was one of those people, I think. Charlie begins with an H.
I was going to say Hoff, but I don't think
that's not right, the right name. Another economist who left shortly thereafter. Seemed really kind of in mourning about the whole thing. And but there was this other collection of people who just appeared to me to be scrambling over the leavings. And I thought it all terrifically unseemly. And I remember being quite annoyed because it seemed to me I wasn't sure at that point how I was going to put my demography center together. Demography is inherently an interdisciplinary business. The members of the Population Association of America are historians and people in public health and statisticians and economists as much as they are sociologists. And so one real possibility would have been to put this thing together as a kind of an interdisciplinary institute in the social sciences. But I was informed quite clearly that that would not be proper to think about doing that because SSRI was the interdisciplinary institute in the social sciences. And so it was occupying that space, and so I had to go off and do my thing within the Department of Sociology, you see, and we could invite in Ferners if we wanted to.
Did you ever discuss this with anybody else?
Yes, I discussed this at the time.
There must have been people who would like you to have done this outside of SSRI. Yes. Who could have put pressure on SSRI?
Chatted with a lot of people who should have known and should have been prepared to do something and weren't.
People at what level?
I'm trying to remember, who did I talk to? Who do I remember talking to? I know that I talked to Bert Fisher about this. Now, Bert was Sewell's right-hand man at the time, and Sewell was chancellor at this time. Now, they were very busy with other things, by God. Mm. I think I passed a word with Leon Epstein, who was LNS dean, about this at some point in time, and his reaction was, well, of course, that SSRI is... And I think that the universe... I think that there had been a little contract there with Guy Orcott that this would be the interdisciplinary thing in the social sciences. And until they made it non-interdisciplinary, that is, until somebody decided that they would fold it into the Department of Economics, that that was the doctrine. And because I'm pretty sure that Leon told me that, I know Bert told me that this was just exactly how it was going to have to be. And I think at one time or another, I may have talked to Bernie Cohn about this, passing off the cuff, because Bernie was associate graduate school dean in those days.
And were they aware of what was going on in the SSRI?
Well, I suppose. They were having to pick up its leavings and bills. I don't know. One or two of them. Boy, that was a long time ago, and I really was not... I was learning my way around and who was who. But I'm pretty sure that some of those people were on committees. There was a lot of committees. There was SSRI, its own self. And by the time I arrived, the computing part of SSRI had been carved off as a separate animal. So there was DACC and DIPLS. Now, Bri Curl was apparently been charged with trying to figure out what of that to save. And so Bri could tell you stories about
that. He was associate dean of the graduate school and then vice chancellor. Which stage is he?
At this point, he was being vice chancellor. Well, I don't know. He was vice chancellor to Sewell. Where was he under the previous administration?
He was associate. Okay. He only became vice chancellor under Sewell in December of 1967 or so.
What happened then was that he worked this deal as graduate school associate dean.
I guess I'll turn the tape.
This is what everyone tells me, that Bri was the guy that did the deal. Sewell has told me and has told me that they tried to look over the leavings. That in the administration they tried to look over the leavings of SSRI to figure out what was important to put money into and to save. And they concluded that maybe the data library business was important, and so it should be saved as an activity. And Bri seemed particularly invested in the data library part of the thing. And others seemed to think that the computing part of the thing was important to save. So those were made separate enterprises with separate board of directors. And I'm pretty sure I was on all three of the damn things at one time or another. And it was terrifically confusing as I came here.
But not with very much to work with, from what you say.
SSRI had very little money to work with, and people were squabbling over the leavings. The data library service, data and program library service, seemed to be trotting along as a device for getting data from other places, particularly from survey houses, and so on. And so it seemed to be all right and have a little bit of money. The programming part of the thing was going big guns, and as I arrived was losing money hand over fist. It was running deficits of like $300,000 a year.
That's right.
Something like that. And that's when I first ran into Bernie Cohen, because he would have been associate to graduate school dean after Bry, I suspect. Mm-hmm. And he was coming over here just madder than a wet hen, because somebody in the computing enterprise was not keeping their books right, or didn't know they were.
Martin David said that it was some way that a failure in accounting at the university level that led to that big deficit.
Well, I don't know anything. I was a new boy on the block. I came in and was in these meetings and was listening to people yell at each other, and busy trying to get work done through that place, not finding it a very successful place to get work done. I mean, I really came here and it looked as though SSRI was supposed to be the vehicle for interdisciplinary stuff, and it looked as though this data and program, or the DACC, was Social Sciences Data and Computation Center, was supposed to be the chief computing facility. And to be frank, I thought the computing facility was incompetent. Jim would hire programming up there, and we just didn't get very much product, and wound up, we quit hiring our own people and do things. And utterly went off on our own hook, because it just didn't work. They were off building weird, large programs, systems to do things that didn't make any sense. We're taking a lot of people for a lot of money. NSF had a lot of money into them, and I wanted to stay. If you're in the money getting business, you want to keep your hands clean. And I didn't want to have anything to do with something that looked to me like it wasn't going to pay off, so I sort of cleared out. So the things didn't look real terrific on that end. And so one reason I went ahead and one of the reasons we did our own computing independently of anybody else was that enterprise was so difficult to deal with and was so strange. So we went on our own way.
Do you know who was responsible for making it that way?
Don't know. Can't even remember who was directing that enterprise at the time.
Well, Dick Day, wasn't he?
Well, Dick was doing SSRI.
Oh, I see. All right,
okay.
Yes.
And as near as I could tell, Dick, it was in Holt. Charlie Holt is the other guy I was thinking of. Does that name ring
a bell
to you? Yeah.
Oh, I said Hoff, didn't I? Yeah,
yes,
Holt.
Yes, but it was Holt, yeah. And Dick and Holt seemed to be seriously in mourning for an idea that had come apart. And I gather Zellner had left and kind of mourning that it wasn't going to work or something. But in the computing thing, someplace in there, Dennis Eigner had something to do with that. Maybe Dennis Eigner was into it. Subsequently, Lyle Christensen had something to do with that enterprise. Sort of run by economists for quite a while. And then, political scientist who's still here, Jack Dennis.
And what just happened to it?
Well, it still exists, essentially, the computing part of the operation. Eventually, I turned my hand to trying to cope with it. Came on bad days, and I got made director, and worked out a deal to try to hand it over to Mac, the computing part of the thing. So now it's on the third floor, and occupies all the space that the Demography Center used to occupy on the third floor. The whole building has been renovated, and it's a Mac, that is the computer center's retail store on the main part of the campus there, and has lots of nice facilities, and is a place you can get at. Those guys did occupy the space up here that we've now taken over.
Was Wack the name of the man?
Elton Wack was the business manager.
He's not the German you spoke of.
Not the German, no. Elton was the dean's man in the thing. Elton was put in, I think, by somebody else, by the deans to.
We better stop, hadn't we?
Yeah, but let me finish that.
Yes, all right.
We do have to stop, because I better answer my phone.
Okay.